This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up on the program this morning, a $2 billion infrastructure bank for Pacific projects at the centre of Australia's pivot to the Pacific, set to be announced later this morning by the Prime Minister Scott Morrison. We'll have the details on that. We'll also get a little bit of US politics as we look at the results of the midterm elections, including a first for Guam. And why is a women's group calling to ban yeast in Solomon Islands? We'll have the answer to that shortly. Good morning, I'm Lauren Beldy. Thank you so much for your company this morning. First, though, Papua New Guinea is clearing refugees out of its capital city ahead of next week's APEC summit. More than 20 refugees from Manus Island who had been in Port Moresby for medical treatment have been sent back to the island. Another 20 refugees who are still in Port Moresby will be flown out this week. PNG police say it's part of security preparations as the country gets ready to host the region's leaders, including Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, Chinese President Xi Jinping and US Vice President Mike Pence. Here's PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting.
If a refugee on Manus Island requires considerable medical treatment, they're flown to the capital Port Moresby and put up in a hotel near a hospital. But last Friday, several refugees were removed and taken back to Manus Island.
At 4 a.m, I was woken up by the shouting of police with a list in his hand.
This refugee doesn't want to be identified, so this isn't his real voice. He says he was at the hotel that night.
The police opened every room with a master key, looking for the guys on their list. It was a very frightening situation.
21 refugees who'd been brought to Port Moresby for medical treatment have now been sent back to Manus Island. The ABC hasn't been able to contact any of the refugees who were removed, but another refugee on Manus Island, Baruz Buchani, says he's spoken with some of the men who were returned.
Most of them are still sick and they didn't receive medical treatment on Port Moresby. Authorities told them that they will bring them back to Port Moresby after 4 weeks.
He says some people are worried that won't happen.
People are so upset. They are worried.
Mr. Buchani says there have been 5 self-harming or suicide attempts in the past week.
One of them was in Port Moresby. He was among those people who were supposed to transfer to Manus. But they didn't send him to Manus and they sent him to a hospital on Port Moresby.
The repatriations come as Port Moresby prepares to host the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Leaders Summit. Leaders from across the region, including Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, Chinese President Xi Jinping and US Vice President Mike Pence, will all be taking part. When asked during a press conference, PNG's Police Commissioner Gary Barkey said the refugee removals weren't related to APEC.
I think this is a normal support that we've been giving to immigration. So it has come at a time when APEC is also on the ground here in Papua New Guinea. So it is an ongoing activity.
But it's not connected? Are you saying they're not being removed because of APEC?
Another high-ranking police officer told the ABC that returning the refugees to Manus was about ensuring they were accounted for. He insisted those returned to Manus Island had completed their treatment. But in a statement responding to further questions from the ABC, the PNG Police Department said the repatriations were a part of APEC security. The statement says,
a total of 21 refugees in Port Moresby for medical reasons were repatriated to Manus as part of security preparations for the APEC Leaders Summit in Port Moresby next week. The remaining 20 refugees in Port Moresby will be flown back to Manus Refugee Centre either on Thursday or Friday this week on a chartered flight.
Police say since being returned to Manus Island, there have been no major incidents and the refugees are being monitored closely. But Baruz Buchani says people on Manus are struggling.
We have many people here are struggling to just survive.
That's Baruz Buchani there, a refugee on Manus Island. Ending that report by our PNG correspondent, Natalie Whiting. Well, Manus Island will still likely be front of mind for some attending the high-level talks at next week's APEC summit in Port Moresby. Last week, Australia and PNG formally announced the joint redevelopment of the port at the island's military base, leading to speculation about what kind of Australian military presence Manus might see in the future. Some analysts have welcomed the news, saying it could serve as a military training centre for regional partners and helps to cement Australia's strategic interests in the region amid concerns of an increasing Chinese military presence. But not everyone is happy about the announcement. Bowes Parkop is the governor of the National Capital District, which includes Port Moresby, but he's also a member of the National Executive Council, as well as originally being from Manus Island. He says he wasn't aware of the decision before it was announced.
I've expressed my concern in this regard. Also, for me as a person originally from Manus, you know, we have been done, you know, Manus people have been done hard by this asylum deal, created a problem in Manus, painted a portrait of Manus as being a hard place, like a hell in the Pacific. And now we are coming up with this initiative, which the terms and condition of which are not very clearly spelled out. And it's clearly something that is in the interest of Australia more than PNG. I've expressed it to the Prime Minister too that I should be included. I want to be included in the negotiating team. So we can, if this decision does go ahead, that we come up with a better terms and condition or better bargain than, you know, this whole deal about the asylum seekers.
That was Powers Parkop, Governor of the National Capital District, who hails originally from Manus Island. Well, last week it was the joint redevelopment of the port at Manus. This week, the Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison is set to unveil plans for a multi-billion dollar infrastructure bank to fund projects for Australia's Pacific neighbours. Scott Morrison is announcing his pivot to the Pacific in a speech to be delivered in Townsville in Queensland later today. Andrew Green is the ABC's national security and defence reporter, and I spoke to him a short time ago. Andrew, what do we expect the Prime Minister to announce today?
Well, this is a big speech from the Prime Minister and is taking part, as you say, or is taking place as the Prime Minister tours Queensland. But there has been a renewed focus on the Pacific in recent times with announcements recently with Papua New Guinea and growing concerns about China's influence in this part of the world. Now, today, Scott Morrison will declare that it's time to, quote, open a new chapter in relations with our Pacific family. And the centrepiece of his announcement is this $2 billion infrastructure bank. Now, we don't know very much about it. We don't know where the funding will come from, when it will be set up, or precisely how it will operate, but perhaps some of those details will start to emerge later today. He says he'll also be pledging in the speech, Mr. Morrison, to strengthen defence cooperation in the region. And of course, as I mentioned, this does come with the backdrop of China's growing influence in the region and concerns in Canberra about that. But the Australian Infrastructure Financing Facility, as it will be known, will issue grants for long-term loans for high-priority projects, including telecommunications, energy, transport and water. And to complement this new fund, the government plans to give Australia's Export Financing Agency access to an extra $1 billion to invest in projects which it, quote, has a broad national benefit for Australia. So we're really seeing both sides of politics. Bill Shorten also last week highlighted the growing concerns about China's rising influence in the region. And today we're seeing the government, like Labor, stepping up commitments for that part of the world.
So Scott Morrison's announcement comes as the foreign minister begins talks with her Chinese counterpart in Beijing. You mentioned a little bit there about concerns of China's influence in the region. How will the Pacific funding be received in China?
Well, this will be a very interesting point. We had late yesterday the government announcing that it will block a Hong Kong-based company from a massive gas investment in Australia. And the timing of that is very curious because it was just as Maurice Payne was heading to Beijing for a long-awaited meeting with her Chinese counterpart. There has been somewhat of a diplomatic freeze. by China towards Australia in recent times. So the timing is, if anything, a little bit awkward for Maurice Payne as she heads into Beijing. And then today to have the Prime Minister making this big commitment to the Pacific, which is being read by everyone as a counter to China's growing influence, it is a little bit curious, the timing. So that may add to the complications for Maurice Payne as she tries to smooth relations over with her Chinese counterpart.
It's the ABC National Security and Defence reporter Andrew Green there.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
I'm Lauren Beldy. Thanks for your company this morning. Let's go to some news elsewhere in the region. And the Council of Women in the Solomon Islands province of Malaita is calling for restrictions on the sale of yeast. While yeast is commonly used for baking bread, it's also a key ingredient in the production of illegal alcohol known as kwaso. Solomon Islands police say the consumption of kwaso is one of the biggest problems facing communities and is the cause of antisocial behaviour and criminal activities. The Malaita Council of Women, which operates a shelter, says kwaso is tearing apart some families. In Honiara, here's Evan Wasuka.
As the weekend approaches, the shelter for women in Malaita's provincial capital, Auki, will start to get busy as it prepares for women seeking refuge. The majority of cases are linked to kwaso consumption. Martha Rurai is the president of the Malaita Provincial Council of Women, which runs the shelter.
We have now received more than 500 victims coming to our centre, and these victims have come up with an issue of husband drinking kwaso and coming home threatening, coming home beating up and coming home destroying the home, and even the children are emotionally affected. So it's all about kwaso.
Ms. Rurai says one way to deal with kwaso is to restrict the key ingredient, yeast, which is commonly known by its brand name, Maori Pan.
Produce a card, a special card where authorized people only can be given marupan to them, like the pastors.
A 2016 report by NGO Oxfam on alcohol and substance abuse found that 60% of young people surveyed in Solomon Islands had used kwaso in their lifetime. The report found that kwaso use was higher in Malaita compared to other provinces. Auki resident William Ekotani says kwaso is easily available and can be bought for as little as 10 Solomon dollars for a 300-milliliter bottle. He says swearing and fights fueled by kwaso have now become commonplace.
As a result of drinking kwaso, it goes then to create a lot of criminal activities in the communities, and they don't respect their families and even the people in their own communities, and also with their leaders as well.
Martha Rurai believes that an intervention by blocking ingredients is the way to go. Another option, she says, is to stop the importation of yeast and bring in pre-mixed flour instead.
There's a pre-mixed flour where everything is already mixed in the flour. There would not be any maruka sold. So if that flour could be manufactured as pre-mixed flour, and then we could now have no marupan selling in the shop.
In the Solomon's capital, Honiara, Dr. Pedikal Togamai has seen all too often the damage drinking kwaso has done to young people.
It can cause acute pancreatitis. This is a very, very serious condition that it leads to death of patients. They come in with severe and very abdominal pain. Other cases, they cause separated ulcers in the stomach. They come in vomiting of blood and passing black bloody stools as well.
Dr. Togamai works at the emergency department of the National Referral Hospital.
Just last week, we've seen three cases that came in because of upper gastric bleeding. So it's almost every week we see those cases.
Over the years, the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force has used raids on kwaso as their key response to the problem. But with little impact made in slowing down kwaso production and consumption, the police are now turning to prevention measures as well. Assistant Commissioner Joseph Manelugu is in charge of dealing with Solomon Islands' kwaso problem.
Police need to go down to the communities and educate the people what the kwaso is harming, because we have been trying in the past doing reinforcement and raids, but it's not actually worked well. Problem is still continuing increasing, so we are deciding to do the awareness or the proactive approach to our communities. so that they know exactly what is the harm, and also other stakeholders will assist and ask what will be the impact.
The Malaita Council of Women plans to lodge a formal submission to the provincial government to impose restrictions on yeast. Assistant Commissioner Manelugu says similar ideas have been raised in other provinces, and he will meet with stakeholders in Malaita when he travels there later this month.
Also has been made because of the Mori Pan. So we will look into what the Malaita Council of Women have initiated or tried to put forward to us, and we will see to it, and we'll work together how best we will work on that.
That's Solomon Islands Police Assistant Commissioner Joseph Manelugu, ending that report by Evan Wasuka. Well, Guam has made history by electing its first female governor in the American midterm elections. Democrat Lou Leon Guerrero is one of many firsts for the U.S. and its territories, as the results show a record number of minorities making it into Congress in Washington. Pacific Beat reporter Yara Murray Outfield has been following the midterms. Yara, what's happened in Guam?
Good morning, Lauren. So, of course, listeners may know that Guam in the North Pacific is what's known as an unincorporated organized US territory. So it's a part of the US, but it doesn't have the full representation or voting power that US states get. But Guam does democratically elect a governor and a legislature at the same time that the mainland US votes in its midterm elections, which is what happened yesterday. So due to its size and due to the time zone, Guam was one of the first parts of the US to have results, and it elected Lou Leon Guerrero, who's from the US Democrat Party, as the territory's first female governor. So she'll be replacing the governor, Eddie Calvo, who was a Republican who'd been in office since 2011. Ms. Guerrero has had experience in politics before. She served as a senator five times from 1994. She had left political life, and she was serving as the president of the Bank of Guam until she announced that she would be contesting this particular vote. And she's told Guam's Pacific Daily News that she's humbled by the result.
Feeling very good, feeling very humbled for this day, feeling very excited about what we need to do to move forward our island, and wanting to get to work as soon as we can.
That's the governor-elect of Guam, Lou Leon Guerrero there. So a female governor of Guam for the first time. And Yara, there are also more women elected into the legislature.
That's right. So as well as a female governor, there's also 10 female representatives elected as senators. And there's only 15 seats, so that's a really big majority. The governor-elect has called that a super majority. Here's what she told the Pacific Daily News.
It sends a message that women can be equally participative a leader in the governance of our island, both in the legislature and in the executive branch. I think that's, to me, that's an amazing thing and a great message and a great reputation for our island. So I like it.
So that's the governor-elect of Guam, Lou Leon Guerrero there. And Lauren, American Samoa has re-elected its Republican Congresswoman Amua Amata with a landslide victory. It's been reported she's won 83% of the vote, so easy there to take her seat back.
Wow, so a majority of women in Guam's politics and a female governor re-elected in American Samoa. Yara, that trend has been reflected elsewhere in the US as well.
So yeah, it's been quite a historic vote all round for these midterms. So firstly, there's been a record number of women actually contesting the vote this year, as well as a record number entering Congress. So there'll be at least 95 congresswomen, breaking the previous record, which was 85. It's been another day of firsts. We've seen the first openly LGBT person elected to represent Kansas, the first Native American women ever elected to Congress, and the first two Muslim women ever elected to federal Congress as well. And at 29 years old, we've seen the youngest woman elected to Congress. In Colorado, we've also seen the country's first openly gay man elected as a governor. And it's been a concerted swing from the Republican Party, which is Donald Trump's party, towards the Democrats in Congress. Donald Trump doesn't seem too worried about that, though. He's reflecting on the fact that it's quite common for sitting presidents to lose support in these midterms.
Just look at the results. Midterm elections are disasters for sitting presidents and administrations. This has been a very successful, and look, you can write it any way you want, and if you disagree with me, this has been an incredibly successful one. You look at the races.
U.S. President Donald Trump there. And Lauren, the final votes are still being confirmed across the U.S., so we may see even more history made in coming days. But all eyes are on President Donald Trump and the recent breaking news of the firing of his Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. So that's the latest developments from the U.S. there.
That was our Pacific Beat reporter, Yara Murray Outfield, bringing you that update. Well, evacuees from Vanuatu's volcano-hit Umbai Island are being turned away from food centres in the capital, Port Vila, with supplies running dangerously low. The number of evacuees in and around Port Vila has increased from 600 to around 1,200 since the government ordered a complete evacuation of Umbai 2 months ago, and aid groups say they're struggling to cope. I spoke to Pacific Beat reporter Nick Fogarty a short time ago and began by asking just how bad the situation has become.
Well, an increasing number of evacuees from Umbai are arriving in Port Vila, with most of them coming via the islands of Maiwo or Santo, which are a lot closer to Umbai than Port Vila is. Henry Vera is with the Port Vila Disaster Committee, and he says while they established a relief centre from the first day Umbai and started arriving there, up until now it's been propped up by donations from businesses and private individuals. These are now running out, so now they're making another urgent appeal to individuals and businesses. And a few days ago, they approached the government through the National Disaster Management Office to see what they could provide.
So the government hasn't yet provided any supplies to those evacuees who are in Port Vila.
That's right. Earlier this year, the government chose Maiwo as the designated evacuation point for Umbaians, and they're sticking to this by only providing supplies to people who've moved to Maiwo, although they have also extended some help to people on Santo in recent weeks. Henry Vera says it's not just the evacuees who are struggling as supplies run out in Port Vila, but host families as well.
Well, the thing is that when they're in Port Vila, there's no evacuation centre. So what is happening is they're moving in with families who are already based in Vila. But you have families, you know, some families, they can increase by maybe 50%, some 100%, some even 400-500% in one household. So we know for a fact that a lot of families who are hosting this evacuees are actually facing, you know, quite difficult times at the moment.
It's Henry Vera there. But Nick, does the government have any intention of providing aid to these evacuees in Port Vila?
Well, I spoke to the National Disaster Management Office's Communications Officer, Presley Tari, and he says the NDMO has been having meetings with the government's Council of Ministers, and they've raised the issue of evacuees in Port Vila but are waiting on a decision. But he says at this stage there are plans to stop the provision of all supplies, including on Maiwo and Santo, on the 26th of November, which is when the state of emergency officially ends. It's already been extended this year, though, so there's a possibility it could be extended again. Here's what Presley Tari had to say.
There's been some meetings going on, but at the moment we're still waiting for the government to support the people back in Vila and Santo, especially in Vila, because what happened during the state of meeting, the order was saying they have to go to Maiwo. So the government at the moment, this week while we're speaking, we have more than 1,000 of rice going again to Maiwo, the last push of dry rations. So for Port Vila, we're still waiting for the answer from the government whether to give the people the food or not.
That's Vanuatu's NDMO Communications Officer, Presley Tari, ending that Q&A with our reporter, Nick Fogarty. Well, a World War II battleground in Papua New Guinea that lay forgotten for 76 years has finally been honoured with a monument, thanks to the tireless work of one descendant. 133 Australians lost their lives in the Battle of Oivi Gurari, which was fought in PNG near the end of the Kokoda campaign. But one of the reasons it hadn't been recognised is that it's not on the Kokoda track. Here's Lucy Murray.
At Gurari, a special welcome for the descendants of those who fought here. They're here to unveil a monument honouring the 133 Australians who died in the Battle of Oivi Gurari 76 years ago. Fought near the end of the Kokoda campaign, but off the Kokoda track, it was the first time the Australians managed to engage the Japanese out of the jungle in an open space.
All those other battle sites have got monuments, plaques, but at Gurari there's absolutely nothing. And Gurari was the biggest battle of the New Guinea campaign up until that point.
The monument would never have been built if it wasn't for the work of John Tannock. His father was wounded there, his helmet shredded by shrapnel.
These young blokes, they're not getting any recognition. They've largely been forgotten.
The Queensland avocado farmer spent 2 years fighting red tape in Australia and PNG.
Well, good morning. My name is John Tannock.
He also took on the task of cold-calling the relatives of the fallen to invite them to the unveiling. He methodically searched the white pages for anyone with the same last name as those killed who still lived in the same town.
Probably for every 20 or 30 calls I make, I might jag someone.
One of those was 92-year-old Mari Murray. Her two brothers died moments apart in the battle.
I'll never forget that. You can't forget those things.
While her health prevented her from attending, her daughter went to Gurari in her place with a jar of dirt from the family cattle station in Forbes, New South Wales, to place on their graves.
My father lost a lot of good mates at Gurari, blokes he talked about over the years, and I think he'd be very pleased that something was done to remember them.
Their names now written in stone.
That's Lucy Murray reporting. And that ends this edition of Pacific Beat. I will be back at the same time tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time. Otherwise, catch us again at 3 p.m. PNG time with Richard Hewitt. I'm Lauren Beldy. Thanks so much for your company this morning. Bye for now.